Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Friday, April 24th, and we're diving deep today with our macro, geopolitics, AI, blockchain edition, a hefty one as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And hefty is an understatement. It feels like we're mapping a new renaissance, all these seemingly disparate fields converging and influencing each other, like the frescoes of the Sistine Chapel demanding a holistic view.
Always with the art, Alex. But seriously, we're starting with the escalating geopolitical risks and how they're fundamentally reshaping energy markets. Is a $150 oil price inevitable?
That's the question. Then we'll zoom into the U.S. economy. Despite the positive headlines, are we overlooking critical cracks, and where are the real investment opportunities hiding?
Speaking of overlooked things, AI. Everyone's talking about ChatGPT, but how is it actually changing tech infrastructure? We'll get into the nuts and bolts, not just the hype.
We can trace that further. Finally, we're tackling DeFi security. Can decentralized finance truly live up to its promise with the current level of exploits? Because frankly, the numbers aren't encouraging.
Right up. A lot to unpack. You know, when we started the show, I thought blockchain was the biggest headache. Now it's AI.
Welcome to my world, Maya. Let's get started.
As of February 2026, tankers departing the Persian Gulf are just now arriving at their destinations, 6 weeks later. That delayed impact, as Ole Hansen points out, is what we're talking about today, geopolitical risks and energy markets. Why are we suddenly obsessing over this now, though? It feels like the Middle East has been tense for a while.
The data tells a story. The risk isn't the initial shock. It's the second and third derivative impulses, as James Crombie, Trey Parker, and Phil Brendel framed it. That's the ripple effect through global production dynamics, especially as it pertains to oil and gas feedstock. Specifically, disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz, seemingly contained, are surprisingly giving U.S. chemical producers an edge against Asian competitors.
So chaos benefits someone. That's comforting, I guess. But a short-term advantage for U.S. chemicals doesn't seem like a crisis averted. What's the bigger picture here?
The bigger picture is credit. Parker highlights a cascading effect beyond immediate inflation. Asian supply chain disruptions create opportunities in the U.S. chemical sector, and that liquidity is becoming a key differentiator for investment. It's a window for credit investment in a volatile market.
Liquidity is the life raft in a shipwreck, then. That makes sense. But is this a sector-specific blip, or is there something larger happening?
Larger, definitely. Sycamore Tree Tips notes the surge in Chinese chemical capacity combined with a deglobalization trend. This isn't just about one blockade, it's about a fundamental shift in production geography favoring US and European companies.
Deglobalization again. It feels less like a strategic plan and more like everyone panicking and pulling inward.
Panic certainly plays a role, but China's behavior is far more deliberate. As Katie Martin and the team at China Shock 2 lay out, China's evolving economic role is a key factor. They're transitioning from low-cost manufacturer to superpower in high-tech, including EVs, solar panels, and machine tools.
Okay, so China is building itself a fortress. What does that have to do with oil?
Everything. China's substantial oil reserves, built through deliberate long-term planning, rooted in a Mao-era mentality, position it to both benefit from and navigate this energy crisis. They're playing both sides, green energy and coal production, prioritizing self-sufficiency. They have close relationships with both Iran and Gulf states.
Playing both sides. That's diplomatically terrifying.
It is. Their proximity to both Iran and the Gulf states necessitates a delicate geopolitical balancing act. Assisting Iran risks straining relations with major oil suppliers like Saudi Arabia. It's a high-stakes game of risk management. And it highlights why they're accumulating oil. It's a strategic buffer.
All right, so China is the stable hand in a chaotic world, quietly building its empire while everyone else frets. But what does this mean for actual energy prices?
Ole Hansen's analysis is critical here. Crude oil markets are in backwardation. Deferred contracts like December 2026 WTI are trading at a premium. This isn't just a temporary spike. It's a trading opportunity, especially for those willing to navigate the physical delivery lags.
Backwardation, explain that to me like I'm five.
Future oil is more expensive than oil right now. It suggests strong demand and supply concerns. People are willing to pay more for oil later, believing it will be scarcer then. It's a $5 per barrel roll yield, equivalent to a 15% annualized return, even without spot price increases.
15% just for holding oil futures. That's suspiciously good.
It is good, but it's tied to a specific situation. Hansen also notes that U.S. crude oil production remains stagnant despite the favorable price environment. The supply isn't responding as expected, reinforcing the bullish outlook. The full impact of the Iran conflict's supply disruptions hasn't materialized yet.
So we're in the calm before the storm, or at least the slow, agonizing realization of the storm's scope.
and the crisis extends beyond crude oil. The Middle East's expansion into energy-intensive commodity processing, aluminum, fertilizer, even copper, creates broad vulnerability. It's a ripple effect not captured in standard oil market analysis. Think of the entire energy system as a complex machine, a seized bearing in one component throws everything off balance.
A seized bearing, I appreciate the metaphor. And fertilizer, how does that fit into all this?
Fertilizer shortages pose a significant risk to crop yields. Hansen suggests markets are underestimating the immediate effect of farmers planting under-fertilized crops. Soybean oil is already in backwardation, signaling stress.
Okay, so food prices are about to get worse. Wonderful.
Potentially. And it's all happening against a backdrop of a global economy shifting from just-in-time to just-in-case supply chain management. Increased demand for commodity inventories is supporting prices across the board, regardless of economic growth.
Everyone's stockpiling everything. So what do the emerging markets think about all of this?
Michael Kass of Baron Capital is optimistic, aligning with UBS's view. Massive capital investment needs in key industrial sectors, largely located within EM, are driving equity performance. EM outperformed the US by 10% in 2025.
So a lot of investment heading to EM. Is it just about avoiding the West?
Partially, but Kass emphasizes that geopolitical shifts are fundamentally reshaping priorities. National security and strategic commodities now supersede economic optimization. Russia's invasion of Ukraine was the catalyst driving wealth flows to owners of real assets and industrial pricing power, which are disproportionately within EM.
Okay, so it's not just about avoiding risk, it's about actively seeking out what's deemed essential.
There's a signal here, as Anna Wong points out. Current economic growth is narrowly distributed, largely benefiting the wealthiest 10% who own 85-90% of U.S. equities. This concentration, fueled by the AI boom, underscores the narrowness of current prosperity.
So a lot of investment is heading to EM because it's where the real stuff is being made, while the U.S. economy is increasingly reliant on a handful of tech companies.
In a simplified form, yes. And that's creating a divergent world.
And in the context of Iran.
As Paul Sankey keeps hammering home, the situation with Iran is guaranteed to deteriorate for the next 2 to 3 months due to tanker logistics, regardless of potential de-escalation. The market may be underestimating the structural shift in oil prices and the potential for wells shutting down. The Iranian regime's internal instability is more profound than commonly acknowledged. Victoria Coates details a government functioning in crisis mode.
So if Iran shuts down wells, what happens next?
Well closures could extend a short-term issue into a 6 to 12 month crisis. And Ben Ramsey notes that the market is potentially mispricing the risks associated with Zambia's restructured bonds and the complexities of the CI score. He and Christovova both see Egypt and Pakistan as increasingly resilient due to recent policy changes.
Okay, so some EM are looking better, but Zambia is a potential landmine. All of this is a lot. It feels like a very fragile system.
It is. And that's why the uncertainty is so significant. We know the impact of Iran shutting down wells could be profound, but the timing is unclear. We know China is accumulating resources, but we don't know exactly what they'll do with them. We know backwardation exists, but we don't know how long it will last, or whether it will actually translate into sustained price increases.
So Alex, we've seen stock market highs despite well everything. Is this resilience a sign of genuine strength, or are we collectively rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic?
That's a fair question, Maya, and highlights a central tension. The last 40 years of market returns that sustained 12% annualized gain isn't simply about economic performance. It's driven by the concentration of wealth in the top 10%, their preference for stocks, and the shift towards equity-only retirement plans. Corporate buybacks $1 trillion last year redirect cash to stock prices, not necessarily broad-based economic benefit.
Buybacks, right? So less reinvestment, more illusion of growth.
Not entirely an illusion, but certainly a different engine than, say, increased wages driving consumer spending. The U.S. economy currently favors corporate profits, but consumer sentiment remains low, widening the wealth gap. This creates a dissonance, record-high markets alongside stagnant living standards for many.
Let's talk about where the actual opportunities might be then. We've got small caps consistently undervalued. Chris Hussey mentioned a 25-30% discount relative to large caps. Is that finally actionable?
It is increasingly. The recent 10% January bump, historically a good signal, seems to be coupled with animal spirits and anticipated rate cuts. Greg Chuardo believes we're in a favorable time for small caps, anticipating outperformance driven by M&A and IPO activity. The key is that earnings cycles within small caps are expected to be more impactful than in large caps.
Earnings, always a gamble. Chuardo acknowledged the energy crisis as a potential vulnerability.
Correct, and that's a crucial caveat. Small caps are more economically sensitive. Transportation costs, broader energy pressures, these hit them harder. However, it's precisely because of that sensitivity that they're currently undervalued. A strong earnings cycle, if it materializes, will have an outsized effect. Renewed client interest is also emerging after years of limited inflows.
Picks and shovels, then. Focus on the enablers, not the moonshots.
Stepping back, the AI investment opportunity within small caps isn't in speculative software companies. Instead, concentrate on semiconductors, cap equipment, and optical connectivity. This is a long-duration fundamental approach, capitalizing on the AI trend with companies that provide the underlying infrastructure.
So John Deere aside, who specifically are we looking at? Because semiconductors is still awfully broad.
We need to think about memory production. Memory, previously an overlooked expense, is now a major cost driver. Look at the increasing price of iPhones. Companies involved in memory production and supporting the infrastructure for large language models are compelling targets. And within defense, a manufacturing resurgence is taking shape. Companies going public focused on connecting data, drones to ground stations, for example.
Defense, interesting. Chuordo cited recent innovation as particularly promising. What changed?
The geopolitical landscape, obviously. We're seeing innovative companies emerge in areas like drone technology and data connectivity. This isn't just about traditional defense contractors. It's about specialized component manufacturers benefiting from increased investment in areas like unmanned systems.
What about biotech? Seems a little disconnected from the AI geopolitics thread.
It's connected through M&A activity, which signals a potential new IPO cycle. The biotech sector has been relatively quiet for a while, but renewed M&A suggests an awakening. Focus on companies that are being acquired, demonstrating fundamental value.
Okay, tangible. But even with that focus, what about the macro risks? Because a revitalized small-cap sector doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Financial conditions are currently easy, with no issues in private credit. But further rate decreases are desirable for optimal performance. Beyond that, the biggest risk is still the energy crisis. Transportation costs are a key vulnerability.
Speaking of risks, the Markets Happy Hour podcast flagged the Strait of Hormuz closure. Is that overblown, or are we genuinely staring down a supply shock?
David Kelly believes it's inevitable. A U.S.-Iran agreement is seen as necessary to stabilize oil prices. Closure of the Strait of Hormuz would negatively impact the U.S. economy, even with our psychological tendency to increase spending during times of fear, as they note.
Psychological tendency? That sounds optimistic.
It's a counterintuitive observation, but U.S. consumers react differently than Europeans in times of crisis. That said, Kelly warns of a false dawn, acknowledging the looming impact of the Strait of Hormuz. The timeline is the key uncertainty.
Let's dial it down to specifics. Anything we can actively monitor right now? Forget broad sentiment, what's a concrete indicator?
Look at transportation costs and energy prices specifically, and tie them to small-cap earnings releases. A significant divergence between projected earnings and actual performance will be a key signal.
And within sectors?
Watch the performance of companies involved in memory production. The increasing price of iPhones is a leading indicator of demand, but monitor production costs and supply chain dynamics. Specifically, I'd be looking at companies with a clear, demonstrable capacity to scale alongside increasing AI demand.
The Tim Cook-Apple transition, slightly different orbit, but relevant to supply chain resilience, right?
Worth noting, Cook's success was scaling Steve Jobs' inventions through operational excellence in supply chain management and reliance on China for manufacturing. Maintaining that supply chain, however, presents its own risks. Their stock buybacks are also a good illustration of how market resilience can be manufactured.
Manufactured resilience. You're a cynic, Alex.
I'm a realist, Maya. Cook prioritized cost control and workers aren't demanding raises, contributing to sustained earnings despite broader economic anxieties. These are crucial factors underpinning market performance.
So the consumer isn't driving this, corporations are.
Largely. And the inflationary pressures, while present, are unlikely to establish a long-term inflation-prone economy due to factors like income inequality and increased information availability.
Okay, back to small caps then. If we're looking for companies that can withstand a potential energy shock and benefit from AI geopolitics, are we looking at a specific time horizon?
Chuordo anticipates outperformance driven by rate cuts and increased M&A activity. He frames the recent bump as partly animal spirits coupled with a historical pattern. A 10% January gain often signals a positive year. That suggests a window of opportunity through the end of 2024.
And you said something about a potential shift in investor focus.
Yes, as small caps demonstrate stronger fundamental growth, we may see renewed inflows and a shift away from the Magnificent Seven. The key is identifying companies outside the established tech giants, those picks and shovels companies that are enabling the broader technological advancements.
Right. But it feels like everyone's chasing the same picks and shovels now.
Which means due diligence is critical. Look beyond the hype, focus on demonstrable capabilities, and prioritize companies with clear, sustainable competitive advantages. And monitor the Section 301 investigations expected around the summer of 2026 for potential disruptions.
So a specific signal for next week.
Watch the earnings report from Siltronic AG on May 8th. They're a key player in memory production and semiconductor materials, and their guidance will be a strong indicator of current demand and supply chain dynamics within that critical sector. It's a concentrated bet, but a useful data point.
All right, that's a specific actionable signal. Next up, we're diving into AI's reshaping of tech and infrastructure, a fascinating contrast to the picks and shovels approach we've just discussed. So we were talking earlier about BP's restructuring, a huge energy company pivoting, largely driven by investor pressure. It feels almost quaint compared to what's happening inside tech itself. The layoffs at Meta and Microsoft specifically aren't just belt-tightening, are they?
Not at all. The 8,000 jobs at Meta and the 7% at Microsoft aren't simply cost-cutting measures. They're a fundamental strategic shift prioritizing efficiency after a period of massive AI investment. It signals that the initial hype cycle may have outpaced demonstrable ROI, and those companies are responding to investor demands.
Prioritizing efficiency. A polite way of saying we spent a fortune and aren't seeing the returns. But it's bigger than just bad accounting. We're starting to see this ripple effect into the infrastructure layer, right? The sheer demand for compute is insane.
Something to flag here, the build-out of AI is creating a massive bottleneck in compute capacity. OpenAI is aiming for 30 gigawatts by 2030, which is almost the entire current global capacity. That illustrates the scale of the challenge and the opportunity. We're talking about a fundamental reshaping of the data center landscape.
30 gigawatts. That's a lot of toasters. But seriously, this isn't just about building bigger data centers. It's the type of data centers. Intel's recent surge, up 233% since the beginning of 2025, is tied directly to Xeon server processors and AI workloads.
The demand for Intel's server CPUs is a key driver of their success, driven by the inference needs of these AI models. The core shift is towards specialized hardware. Google's TPU splitting training and inference, NVIDIA's Rubin collaboration moving away from general-purpose processors to address this imbalance.
Okay, so traditional chipmakers are pivoting, but that creates another layer. We're seeing these neocloud providers emerge. Companies like Samba Nova offering specialized inference chips. Is this just a niche market, or is it a genuine disruption?
It's more than niche. These are companies strategically positioning themselves to fill the gaps left by the hyperscalers. It's a move away from reliance on purely on-demand compute toward owning more of the AI infrastructure stack. Look at Salesforce's API-first strategy decoupling work from traditional UIs. It's all connected.
Salesforce's shift to an API as the UI model. That's terrifyingly efficient and potentially incredibly powerful. But all this compute power doesn't guarantee good output, does it? We saw what happened with OpenAI's image model, GPT-2, easy fraud, misinformation.
The performance limitations and security risks are significant. Realistic image generation, agentic workflows, those require careful governance. The enterprise adoption is critical for long-term sustainability, but systems like Salesforce gaining importance as foundational systems of record also means increased potential for data exfiltration, requiring scrutinized stores of apps and outgoing agent firewalls.
So it's a mess. Expensive infrastructure, potential for fraud, security vulnerabilities, and as we heard from Deb Desen, a lot of it isn't even profitable yet. TCG Digital's MQ platform is built on an agentic approach, promising a 10x ROI, but that's still an aspiration, isn't it?
It highlights the critical need for demonstrable business value. AI without ROI dies, we've seen that before. Zen's point is that integration with diverse data sources, internal, cloud, external, is key, but the adoption is reliant on clear metrics and trust.
And the token economy is a lie, isn't it? VCs, sovereign wealth funds are effectively subsidizing everything. Chris Posts pointed out that people are protesting price increases that reflect only a fraction of the actual cost.
Two things stand out. It's a multi-layered subsidy, platforms like SimTheory effectively paying up to 70% of the cost. This creates a false perception of affordability and distorts value assessments. Agentic workflows, 8,000 to 30,000 input tokens versus 800 for chat, are inherently expensive and that cost is being masked.
If the costs are hidden and the infrastructure is strained, why is Google seemingly sitting on the sidelines? They have TPUs, the very thing everyone else is scrambling for. Ed Ludlow noted their inactivity is baffling and expensive.
It's a strategic misstep. Google possesses a unique advantage, TPUs, that would allow them to dominate by substantially subsidizing access and bleed out competitors. Their current strategy, focusing on Gemini Enterprise and inference, suggests a shift from model training to platform dominance, but they haven't fully capitalized on their hardware advantage.
It's like they're building a really good engine for a car they're not actually driving. And if they don't, Anthropic and OpenAI are incentivized to disrupt existing labor markets to justify their pricing models. They need to demonstrate enough productivity gain to offset the cost of replacing human roles.
So here's the picture. That's why we're seeing the emergence of the AI change officer role, a mandated budget for AI spending, shifting the sales model from individual users to large contracts with organizations required to allocate funds. This will accelerate the enterprise focus and widen the gap between casual and professional users.
And the whole thing rests on this precarious foundation of build, break, discard. We were talking about concrete earlier, with Mark Miodnik emphasizing the need to stop building to replace and start building to evolve. It's that same dynamic, isn't it?
The pattern is clear. The systemic failure in road maintenance and, by extension, AI infrastructure isn't simply budgetary, but a fundamental mismatch between our economic model and the longevity requirements of the technology. The current reliance on replacing infrastructure rather than evolving it is unsustainable in both cases.
The entire ecosystem is predicated on a fundamentally broken model. And we are only at the precipice of what this infrastructure costs, what it's truly capable of, and how easily it can be manipulated.
The implication runs deeper. This is a moment where the macro, geopolitical, and technological forces are converging, creating a level of uncertainty and potential disruption we haven't seen in decades. The AI revolution is here, but its long-term viability hinges on solving these infrastructure, security, and economic challenges.
You know what I noticed this week? The sheer volume of DeFi exploits feels performative. Like we're collectively building incredibly complex financial Legos, then just letting toddlers smash them.
It's a valid observation. The recent incidents with Kelp.io and Layer 0 are exceeding the combined total of exploits expected throughout 2025, which underscores a systemic failure in security practices and accountability. We're seeing a real accountability gap emerge, mirrored by debates surrounding something as basic as gun control. Simply offering thoughts and prayers isn't cutting it.
Thoughts and prayers for code, right? So let's talk about who actually is liable when this happens. The legal landscape seems uniquely confused.
There's contention around default configurations and duty of care, especially in light of recent events. The Kelp.io/Ov situation, for instance, is pointing to Ov bearing responsibility due to its proximity to end users, despite not being directly at fault. This feels like a novel Swiss cheese model of failure where cascading vulnerabilities across multiple layers, Kelp.io, Layer 0, and Ov, align poorly.
A multi-party failure. Sounds messy and expensive. What about Layer 0 specifically? They configured a single validator, documented best practices say that's bad.
Publicly, they're viewed as culpable, even with potential legal defenses. The single validator setup creates a uniquely vulnerable attack surface, and the lack of detailed information about the RPC injection is alarming, suggesting a wider systemic risk. The attack seems to have required root access to validator nodes.
Root access? Okay, so it wasn't just a script kiddie. Is anyone actually trying to prevent this or just post-mortem analyze it?
The discussion around security flaws is hampered by fear of overregulation, but knowledge sharing is crucial. Plus, Amex's launch of agentic commerce is a significant development. They're taking liability for AI agent errors, setting a new standard.
Amex, of all people, solving the accountability problem. It's absurd. They're building a guardrail, purchase protection, identity verification, while DeFi protocols are still pointing fingers.
Consider this, they're demonstrating a fundamental shift in risk models, and their partners, Delta, Expedia, Hilton, signal real-world implementation. Blockchain is uniquely suited for agentic commerce, but needs to rapidly address its vulnerabilities to compete. Rate-limiting deposit amounts like Spark has implemented could have significantly reduced the impact of the Kelp.io hack.
Stop letting toddlers with unlimited funds play with the Legos. What happens next?
The regulatory landscape is moving towards a fail-to-regulate-yourself paradigm, and the industry needs proactive self-regulation. The expectation of bailouts like Arbitrum's ETH recovery fundamentally alters risk assessment. It's shifting the burden from individual investors to protocols. Looking ahead, by April 2026, pooled lending markets as currently configured will either undergo recapitalization or face catastrophic failure if substantial loss events occur. The critical thing to watch will be how protocols manage user expectations around these inherent risks.
So distilling everything down, it feels like we've been tracing the contours of a system under immense, multifaceted pressure. Energy markets aren't just reacting to headlines, They're revealing a delayed logistical strain, evidenced by those tankers taking 6 weeks longer to arrive, and the $150 price tag is a symptom, not the disease. That logistical chokehold, coupled with China's aggressive capacity buildup, feels like a deliberate recalibration of global leverage.
It's a telling detail. And that leverage is being applied against a U.S. economy, exhibiting a fascinating fragility. Headline numbers are, well, they're headlines. The real story is the concentration of wealth, 85 to 90% in the hands of the top 10%, creating a fundamentally uneven playing field. It's not just that small caps are undervalued by 25 to 30%, it's that the economic narratives are diverging from lived experience, and that divergence is unsustainable. Liquidity is, as we discussed, paramount, but it feels less like a rescue and more like postponing the inevitable reckoning.
And then you layer AI on top of that. The compute demands, OpenAI needing 30 gigawatts by 2030, expose a new bottleneck, a scramble for infrastructure. But even Intel's 233% stock surge doesn't tell the whole story. Profitability remains elusive, security is a patchwork mess, as demonstrated by the Kelp DAO and Layer Zero exploits, and accountability, well, thoughts and prayers don't seem to be cutting it in DeFi anymore.
The exploits are more than just technical failures. They highlight a fundamental flaw in the fail to regulate yourself paradigm. We're building with Legos and toddlers are smashing them. But the AI infrastructure strain, I think, is the most interesting connective tissue. It's forcing a reassessment of value, shifting investment toward the picks and shovels, the infrastructure providers, even as the applications themselves face an existential ROI question.
Which brings us back to the energy piece. If AI adoption requires immense power, and geopolitical risks constrain energy supply, that pushes capital towards and potentially through these bottlenecks. It feels like a feedback loop, a complex system tightening around itself. The Iranian situation, guaranteed to deteriorate, simply amplifies the pressure.
And that tension between genuine economic strength and manufactured resilience is really the core of it. We talked about Google's inaction on TPUs, the uncertainty around long-term inflation. These aren't isolated questions. They point to a broader recalibration, a search for sustainable growth in a world where access to resources and capital is increasingly unevenly distributed. It's a bit like a wildfire spreading. Initial sparks of disruption accelerate through dry underbrush fueled by oxygen.
So what do we watch? Beyond the obvious Iran energy prices, I think the small cap performance is crucial. A true earnings cycle there, coupled with rate cuts, could signal a shift in investor sentiment. And honestly, whether Amex's foray into agentic commerce with liability coverage is a genuine step towards security or a clever sidestep.
Agreed. And let's not forget China's intentions. We see the actions, but the long-term objective remains a critical unknown. The next few months will be telling, a period of potentially rapid destabilizing shifts.
Thanks for joining us today. It's a lot to unpack, and we'll continue to monitor these developments closely. Tune in tomorrow as we dive deeper into the implications of, well, whatever chaos unfolds.